suitcase, trying to find a warm place to spend the night. Heavy rain falling.
Ah, Brooke Benton. That voice that for a certain generation meant a great deal to hear him and his the way he sang. He was born on this day in 1931. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to do our day in history. Before we jump into our show, remind you, you listen to the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA, the voice of the community, 88.9 FM. And support for WEAA is provided by Monroe Shocks and Struts. Information available at monroe.com. And Brooke Benton was born on this day, as was a woman you probably never heard of named Mabel Vernon, 1883, who became an activist for the women's right to vote, an activist in the civil rights movement for black rights in America, picketed at Woodrow Wilson's White House in 1914, came out and said, I'm in love with a woman, and stayed that way the rest of her life. William Golden was born on this day in 1911, author of one of my favorite books of all time, Lord of the Flies. Frances Farmer, the great American actress who was a political activist, was born on this day in 1913, and she was the one who was put into a mental hospital, had a lobotomy, was treated like worse than we would treat our animals, and you can read her story. You should check that out. There's also the day another really one of the more powerful thinkers of this century was born, last century. On this day in 1921, Paulo Freire was born. He wrote a book called The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and one of the most seminal thinkers in power of poor and working people in the world to take control of their own lives, and how he used, that we used, many of us when we worked in the state prisons and other places, used his theories to teach writing, which used the words of the people themselves and their own stories to teach them how to read and write, and it worked. And he was one of the great thinkers of all time, an activist, and Paulo Freire died in 1997. This is the day that Helen Carter was born in 1927, the Carter sisters, fame. This is the day Cass Elliot from Baltimore, Maryland was born. And, of course, the Mamas and the Papas will play some of that during the course of the day. Musician from back in the day, and Soledad O'Brien was born this day in 1956. This is the day that James Garfield, who was assassinated, 20th President of the United States of America, and his assassination by a disgruntled civil employee, a person who didn't get a job, Charles Guiteau, brought this battle to the fore in America that created the Pendleton Civil Service Reform that changed the way America did business. It meant that people who wanted government jobs had to apply for them, had to pass a test, had to be objective criteria, and no longer would have political patronage for jobs. And that's how that came to be. His death made that come to be. This is the day that the Continental Congress passed the first federal budget in 1778. Some people in Congress need to be able to go back and look at the history and see how to do it right. And this is the day of 1881 that Booker T. Washington opened Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And in 1893 on this day, women got the right to vote in New Zealand. America took a little bit longer to catch up. This is the day that Bruno Hauptmann was arrested in 1934 for the kidnapping murder of Charles Lindbergh Jr., the son of Charles Lindbergh. Even though the father was not one of my favorite people, this was a horrendous crime. This is the day in 1952 that the United States would not let Charlie Chaplin come back to the United States of America from a trip to England because of his revolutionary politics. This was the day in 1956, the first international conference of black writers and artists took place at the Sorbonne in Paris. Writers from all across the African continent and the diaspora met together. This is the day in 1957, the first American underground nuclear bomb was exploded. And this day in 1959, Nikita Khrushchev, then premier of the Soviet Union, came to America. They wouldn't let him go to Disneyland. That really happened. This is the day in 1981, a solidarity march of close to a quarter million people went to Washington, D.C. on September 19th to oppose Ronald Reagan's social programs and policies, and to oppose what he did when he fired 12,500 traffic controllers, and a march in Washington to oppose his union policies and his social policies took place on this day in 1981. This is the day that the Washington Post and New York Times published the Unabomber's Manifesto in 1995, and this is the day in 2010, the leaking oil well in Deepwater Horizon was finally sealed. That was this day. It was one more piece we didn't say that I need to say that happened on this day in history. There was a thing called the Camilla Massacre that took place in 1868. It took place in Camilla, Georgia. There was a march from Albany, Georgia to Camilla of black Republicans and a few white allies that marched to maintain the rights that African Americans had gotten after the Civil War. When they got to Camilla, to make their voices heard, they were attacked by a violent group of white revisionists who opened fire from all directions, killed 34 people, to begin the demise of interracial power and justice in Georgia in 1868. Very famous incident in American history. If you don't know it, you should look it up and read about it, and we'll link to it on our website, Camilla Massacre, C-A-M-I-L-L-A. There are many pieces of this history we do not continue to talk about, which we need to, because he who controls the past controls the future, and who controls the present controls the past, so says George Orwell. We are here in studio now. It's time now for our roundup of things happening around the state and maybe a little bit beyond. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages. In the studio today, Hassan Giordano is back in the house, and he is host of Reporters Roundtable, publisher of DMVDaily.com. Good to see us on.
Always a pleasure, Mark.
Davon Love is back. A long absence, but it's our fault he's been absent, not his. He's back, though. Davon Love is director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle and helped run a very powerfully important debate program here at Morgan State University during the summer. Davon, good to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Mark.
Dr. Lawrence Brown's in the house, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University. Good to have you back in the studio.
Hey, hey.
And Krishana Davis is here again, a multi-platform journalist, I like saying that, specializing in news, politics, and fashion, and writing for the Afro-American. Good to have you in the studio.
Good to see you, Mark.
410-319-8888 is the number here. So who watched? We're trying to pull a clip up, but I'm not sure we got it because we're having computer issues, so we couldn't get this clip rolling. I went to the play of O'Malley and Perry, Governor O'Malley and Governor Perry of Texas going at it last night on Crossfire, because Governor Perry made this six-state tour of democratically controlled states to try to get businesses to leave and watch that debate last night. And some people thought the debate was kind of a beginning setup of O'Malley running for president, debating a national... I'm not living it. Y'all, my listeners, I'm laughing. One of my guests, Davon, I made a face as I said that. Running for president. There was an interesting debate. It'd be sort of interesting. We watched last night on Crossfire. Davon, I'll let you start. Did you watch it?
I didn't.
You didn't watch it, man?
No. Let me tell you how I feel about just this whole issue. I kind of see it as people trying to rearrange chairs on the Titanic, you know? I mean, it's like if you look at the trajectory of our state of Maryland, and particularly those of us who aren't generally considered, you know, typically people of color, working people, that aren't really at the center of what drives public policy in this state. And then you look at someone like Rick Perry, who obviously is interested in a kind of free market fundamentalism that many Republicans have endorsed. You know, neither one of those. I mean, you know, it goes back to the fact that the established parties are linked to corporate interests that, you know, continuing to try to think that one gives credence over the other, that one is a better alternative to the other, just leaves us chasing our tails. And so, you know, I think that stuff is a distraction from the actual kind of revolutionary politics that needs to take place.
Hassan.
Well, I think I did watch it, and I love the show, and I love the Situation Room that precedes it. But I think these are two wannabe presidential candidates that have, at this point, absolutely no chance in the world of winning either one of their
I'm
parties.
I'm not sure that's true. But
at this point, I'm not saying, you know, in general. I'm just saying at this point, they're both polling less than 5%. but I think that it is very interesting that Democrats now want to decry Governor Perry because of his politics, and he's pointing to really the facts, when essentially you have the attorney general, who's a Democrat, Doug Gansler, who's running for governor, who's running around the state saying the same exact thing about the O'Malley Brown administration. You've raised 40 new taxes, 32 new fees in the past 7 years, raised taxes historically twice, 2007, 2009. We don't have the number one educational system in the country, as you say. If so, go to Baltimore City schools. This is a Democrat saying it. There's no outcry. But because Perry is saying it, now all of a sudden it's this big outcry of he has to be wrong. When you look at the facts, he's not.
Well, Mark, I didn't see all of it, but I did see clips. I've watched a few clips, and I thought that it was a really kind of lopsided debate. If you ask me, I think Rick Perry made a lot more assertions than Governor O'Malley was able to kind of counter. But Hassan made an interesting point about the educational system. So Governor O'Malley really bolstered that by increasing the educational system to being number one in the past 5 years, that Maryland is able to better increase its job market and its economy and help people be able to be more self-sustainable. And I would have to agree, if you look at a city like Baltimore, that's just not true. So you can't compare everything you can't just compare Baltimore and not look at the other counties as well. But I think that you also have to look at some of like your major city and see that there is an issue. But if you look at, you know, where the educational week, what their six criteria were, it was, you know, whether or not students were being successful. It was whether or not what the teacher assessments looked like. So if you're basing it on that criteria, maybe. But, you know, that's kind of a long stretch to me.
Lawrence, you take it before I throw mine.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't watch the debate. You know, we all know that Rick Perry is an intellectual lightweight, and there's, you know, the thought. I'm scared of the thought of him being president. But it's funny because when he was running in 2012, he was accusing other folks of vulture capitalism, and here he is running around trying to steal jobs from companies from other states. So it's like, you know, here's a guy who's intellectual lightweight and an ultimate hypocrite. And O'Malley, he's an absolute corporate shill as well. We know from his leadership with EBDI and the displacement of over 700 African-American families here in Baltimore, that he's been involved in a crime against humanity, moving people off of land for the sake of Johns Hopkins and the participation of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. So, yeah, I'm not excited about either one of these guys. Definitely not Rick Perry, but O'Malley, I don't think, offers the type of real progressive or revolutionary, as Devon says, politics that we need in this country. So, you know, not really worth my time.
Well, I watched the last 20 minutes of it and looked at some more of it this morning on the web because a friend said it was going to be on a 7, so I told my wife we couldn't go out to dinner. We had to come and watch this stupid thing and I brought Carrie out home, and it was already on by the time I got home. But I watched part of it, and a couple of things just struck me. And I looked through the transcript this morning. We did it here to see if he mentioned Texas one, if either one mentioned it. And I was surprised O'Malley didn't. Then again, I'm not surprised. Texas One is the coalition of companies that have supplied the money for this campaign in all these states for Perry. That includes Maryland-based companies like Martin Marietta. These are companies who want to hold down wages, who have this giant corporate agenda to move jobs certain places where they can have a better climate for their profits. And I'm just surprised that Martin O'Malley, as a Democrat, wouldn't stand up and go, well, let's talk about who funded your campaign and who and why this is going on and who's really behind all this, you know. Or the fact that Texas really attacking Perry because Texas has one of the worst school systems in the country. Underfunded. Its Dallas system is terrible. You think Baltimore's bad?
But if you think about it, if you're running for president of the United States, why would you be trying to argue about your state being better than another as opposed to presenting a plan about how America can improve as a whole? You know, why would you be trying to steal jobs? Why would you be competing about which education system is better than the other? I mean, you ought to be saying that we need a vision for this country that will improve education substantially, you know, in the military-industrial complex and all this money that we send overseas and use that to rebuild our infrastructure at home. That's the kind of vision that these candidates ought to be talking about, but they're not. And that's something that we ought to really look at.
And it showed that what he alluded to earlier, that the governor, O'Malley, is a lightweight when it comes to debates. Like that's some of the things that you just mentioned, Mark, should have been injected in this 30-minute platform to be able to put the focus back on the Texas. And it just wasn't. And it became all about Maryland. And I think one of the greatest lines to come out of it, and the governor was right, is, you know, in Texas, we pray for rain. In Maryland, you tax it. And I think that's the biggest frustration when you talk to any Maryland resident. I don't care if you're in Frederick or Baltimore City. You're taxing rain. You're taxing gas. You have all these regressive
taxes
and fees.
You're not really taxing
rain.
That's people who don't like to tax it.
Yeah,
you're not taxing rain.
It's
you're taxing
hype.
The runoff that comes off of our houses and our pavements that pollute the water.
That's where does it come from? The rain.
No. Right? It comes from all the sediment and stuff we've allowed to build up.
So if there was no rain, you wouldn't be taxing it, right?
No, if you had laws that protected the environment in the first place, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have the problem of runoff that's killing our streams.
So we should tax the citizens and the small business owners who are going to be regressively hurt by these taxes. And same thing with gas tax and all the other taxes. So that's okay to do that. That's a good economic environment for Maryland to be in. I don't think the majority of any business owner or any resident or voter in the state of Maryland would say that.
Anybody else?
Well, I think one thing that we aren't looking at as we compare Maryland and Texas is the cost of living in both states. Overwhelmingly, the cost of living in Texas is lower when you look at transportation, when you look at housing. The only thing that it's more in is health care. As we know, the vast majority of the citizens in Texas don't have health care. But I think that's one issue, one point that wasn't addressed or made at all that I thought would kind of have maybe changed the tide and the comparison and give people a real perspective of what people are talking about when they mention jobs and when they mention minimum wage jobs, and when they talk about, you know, Maryland being right next to D.C. when bringing more government jobs. I think that will give people a wider perception of what's really happening.
And in Texas, I mean, the jobs in Texas they've created have been low-wage jobs. These are not jobs that can sustain a family. I mean, the reason that the cost of living is so low in Texas is because people don't make any money in Texas.
But they have a job, though. And that was mentioned last night. It was like, well, Malin, well, you're creating all these minimum wage jobs. And Governor Perry was like, yeah, but we're creating jobs. What are you doing?
We said,
I think anybody who's not working would love to have a minimum wage job.
I think
right
anybody
now.
Who's not working and has a job minimum wage, like you're seeing here throughout the minimum wage industries in Maryland, are organizing to demand higher wages because that minimum wage is not enough to live on.
And they're going to kill small business doing that.
Listen, that's baloney. That is such baloney.
They
because
are.
I know a lot of small business people in the city, and we're actually sure we should have on the show, it's bringing some small business people in here. Mm-hmm. People like, who let's say, Wells, not Wells, but the wine store in Hamden. I forget the name of the store, just block Wine Source. This guy is a left-wing person, mm-hmm. runs a company, mm-hmm. pays all his people, gives them health care, pays them decent wages, mm-hmm. pays his taxes. He would get on this program and say, that's baloney. It's a Republican line mm-hmm. to say people shouldn't pay their fair share of taxes mm-hmm. to take care of our society. Mm-hmm. I think that's a load of bull.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to jump on you for a second about that, Mark.
Go ahead, girl.
Last year in the AFR, I wrote an article about how raising the minimum wage would impact black businesses mm-hmm. and minority-owned businesses. And a lot of people said if they had to increase the amount that they're paying their employees the wages by a certain percent, where are they going to make up that money? So they either have to increase the amount of their goods or they have to lay off some people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but people cannot live on $8 an hour. If you can't pay a decent wage and you shouldn't be in business.
Then get two minimum wage jobs then. You go into that job knowing
that
the wage
is a certain.
That's
easy for you
to say, Hassan. No, it's because as a small business owner, you can't tell me if I'm paying and I can afford $8 an hour, $7.25 as it currently is, and you're telling me now that I have to pay my employees $10 or $12 an hour, that is malarkey.
But you know,
that means I have to find it at some place.
This type of thinking that we have here is sort of a race to the bottom. You know, we want, you know, how can we pay our employees the least? How can we make sure that we don't have to cover our employees' health insurance? I mean, that's what's wrong with this country today is this thinking that is not about human dignity, but it's all about profit. And I think that is a real concern that we ought to have for this country going forward. When you look at the corrosive effects of everything that's taking place, these mass shootings, the violence that's taking place, the lack of concern for each other. You know, it's rooted in this thinking, individualistic thinking, a race to the bottom about you're out there on your own, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And that's an insidious thing that's going to tear this country apart. It is tearing this country apart.
And I think a part of the issue is that we need a holistic strategy in what it means to empower communities that are historically disenfranchised. And I think sometimes what happens is that these issues just becomes like political football where people are trying to score points instead of thinking about what's the comprehensive way that you can improve the quality of life. I mean, even when we look at, because one thing I find really interesting, you look at Baltimore City, you look at the state of its education system, and, you know, we certainly have the investment that was made through the state legislature to, you know, increase or improve the schools in Baltimore City. One of the things that is important is that we see those things not just as investments in education, but it's also an investment in economic development, right? If you have better schools, you attract families that want to stay there, you know, so that when people are successful, they want to stay in the community because they can raise kids there. So it's important that we look at it as a comprehensive strategy to improve people's quality of life. But I think sometimes these particular issues get put in a political arena where folks are more interested in scoring points for their political party or positioning to run for president instead of actually being rooted in the community in a program that actually does something for the people.
So the question I have in all this, you know, and I was listening to what you all have been saying, that we never hit we kind of get ourselves stuck in, I think you're alluding to, Davon, we get ourselves stuck in the political issues of the moment, you know, and don't talk about what is really happening around us and how to get to that, get to the place where we can talk about the kind of change you need
Hey, I think for the most part, we're very reactionary folks. You know, we wait for the political mainstream to tell us what's on the table to be talked about instead of doing it the other way around. I think a part of it is when people historically disempowered, we don't feel like we have the agency to dictate the agenda. But I think on the other hand, I think a part of the problem is that there's just such a woeful lack of understanding of the conditions that exist in our society. You know, and, I mean, one of the things that I learned, you know, traveling to other countries is that Americans are, you know, the laughing stock of the world in terms of people don't perceive Americans as being particularly intelligent. You know, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that our standards are very low and what it means to actually understand what's going on around us. And I think there's incentives for that because it's easier to herd folks who don't really understand what's going on around them than it is to really engage an educated population. And so I think a big part of what needs to happen is serious conversation, you know, like this show and others, serious conversation about what's actually going on in our community.
So let me open the phone to listen to something, and then we'll come back right here. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. We'll check the Facebook pages in a moment. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Let's go to Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Always good to hear Day and Lawrence on. I wanted to pick back up what Davon just said. You know, what we really ever talk about is abundance, right? And equity is ultimately about a place of abundance, and that's true wealth. And that is a challenge for people who have been historically oppressed, but it's a problem for the country as a whole. And you're absolutely right, Lawrence. We race to the bottom when we talk about minimum wage. I'm a guy. I've actually worked with minority venture capitalists and was paid to give them advice on strategy. And I can tell you, no one makes money worrying about the minimum wage. They will pay you whatever to go take that hill where the hill has profit and money attached to it. It's a place of abundance that creates further wealth. And if we don't operate from that place of abundance where we can be concerned about the least of these and displacement and all the issues that have been raised, then we're not operating in our maximal benefit for ourselves or our society. And we've got to operate from a place of abundance and equity.
Well, thank you. I think the issue in America oftentimes is that we have a zero-sum ideology. And a zero-sum way of thinking about things is that if somebody else is gaining, I'm losing, as opposed to thinking about other people gaining and it being a mutual benefit. We think that if employees, you know, gain a raise, then, you know, there's going to be this real devastating loss to business owners. And I just think that zero-sum thinking is really at the root of a lot of the anxiety that we have in our country because we can't – the people in power and the people that have power – can't envision a scenario where other people are going to gain and they're going to gain as well. And without having a sort of mutual benefit way of looking at the world, then you end up in a situation where you're always fighting people who are trying to improve their quality of life and gain something for themselves and their families.
Right. And I think real quickly, I think it's also important to understand what it means to like what kinds of benefits are we talking about? Because certainly if there's to be justice, there's certain folks that are going to have to give up some things. Right. And so a part of it is teaching people that will make a better society if certain folks give up things. So if you look at, you know, the legacy of slavery in the United States and the way that it's created, you know, the economic inertia that has made it so that in the state of Maryland, you know, 42% of white folks have income that's generated from wealth, whereas only 11% of the wealth of black folks, the income generated from black folks is from wealth that we have. And so if you look at disparities like that, it helps us to understand that if you're interested in genuine justice, you have to address that kind of wealth gap if you're interested in actually mutual benefit for a society that's good for everybody.
About a minute or two to break. Do you want to jump in on the way to break here?
You know, I just think of it different. Bottom line is, you know, I came from an environment where as though I had twofold, African-American male criminal record, and I wasn't begging for a minimum wage job. I didn't care about $7, $8, I don't care if it was $9. I knew that I would be marginalized because of who I am. So I decided to go out on my own, study, do what I had to do to start my own. That way I can employ other people. It's a mindset. We have to be able to re-educate our people to have a mindset of, as he said, not racing to the bottom for a minimum wage job because $7.25 is no better than $8. Let's be honest. At the end of the day, it's just not. But when we have a governmental system, like here in Maryland, where you're raising, even if you raise the minimum wage to $10, but yet you're historically underfunding places like historically black colleges like here, Morgan State University, you're setting people up for failure. And at the end of the day, like Davon said, we have to get real with our political conversation. Stop patting these people on the back like they're celebrities, like the hands are off, the gloves should be on, and start really getting real about issues that are affecting our people.
We're going to take a break. And when we go to break here, you'll be hearing a little Mamas and Papas, Dream a Little Dream, Cass Elliot, Born on This Day. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Or you can go to steinershow.org, click on their banner. It's always there, as is the information about MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We're in the studio here with Hassan Giordano, host of the Reporters Roundtable, publisher of DMVDaily.com, and one of our best city reporters in terms of ferreting out stuff most people don't see in the major papers before he does, Krishana Davis, and that's true. Krishana nice. Davis, multi-platform journalist, writes for the Afro, specializes in the fields of news, politics, and fashion, and one of the new rising reporters, and you can see her work in the Afro-American, which you should read because I've come to read herself all the time now. You're also an excellent reporter.
Until next week, of course.
I was going to say something. I was keeping my mouth shut. I was keeping my mouth shut. I didn't know about it. I wasn't sure I was allowed to say it. Davon Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and Dr. Lawrence Brown, who is political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health at Morgan State University. I want to jump into some city council things because I think they relate to the stuff we were talking about earlier. But let's first go to Eric. You're on the air. Welcome.
I was listening to your show, and I noticed that it seems people forget. Growing up, there was a game called Monopoly. And the thing about Monopoly people forget is once you get it all, the game is over. And that's where we headed. Greed seems to be the thing of the day. In 1969, I know people who made, $7 and $8 just cleaning offices. And this is 2013.
Right.
This is ridiculous.
I'm sorry. Finish up, Eric. I'm sorry.
What's the excuse?
I mean, it raises those kind of issues, Lawrence.
Well, yeah. I think, income inequality is really the issue that's on the table. Income inequality and wealth inequality. But at least with income inequality, what I think the caller is referring to is that the rising income of the folks that are at the top half of the bracket, the top 10% of the bracket, and the flattening, if not declining, wages of those at the bottom. And the rising income inequality is a cause for a lot of the issues. It's behind a lot of the issues in our society, because when you feel like those who already have keep gaining and the people at the bottom keep losing, then all that does is increase the sort of strife, contention, and violence that we're seeing in our society. So income inequality and wealth inequality are two issues that we really got to look at. Not just poverty.
Well, greed is good. And greed is healthy. I mean, when you strive to be better than, when you strive to get everything that you can, I don't see a problem. I think it's just the way we view things. I mean, you don't want to – I think when he talked about America's a laughing stock, it's because we've become so complacent as a country, as the citizens, that everything is afforded to us, and we don't seem to be greedy. We don't seem to want to take that push.
We don't seem
to
be greedy.
I'm not going to go. I'm talking about as individuals, not as a country. Oh. I'm talking about as individuals in this country. We would rather take a job that's giving to us at $9 an hour than say, you know what, I'm going to start my own. I'm going to be greedy. I'm going to go out and do this, and I can be able to then not only sustain my own family, but to be able to give back to others. But that's the problem, man. We look at it as a black versus white thing, and it's really not.
Let me push back a little bit, and Dave, and Krishan, please jump in, and then we'll move on to the city council here. But I'll push back a little bit on that. I mean, I think that that's a trick bag we put ourselves in America. Everybody's not going to be an entrepreneur. If everybody had their own business,
there'd be no employees.
There'd be no employees. I mean, it doesn't work that way in the real world. Some people start businesses, and some people don't. Some people will work for a company for no longer, but used to work for a company for 30 years as an accountant, as a lawyer, as a secretary, whatever those jobs were, make a decent living and wage, raise their families. You don't have to be an entrepreneur to be happy.
No, but when you become that employee at whatever corporation, you don't be complacent and say, this is where I want to stay. You want to be able to say, I'm going to climb that corporate ladder, so to speak,
or get more. That's greed.
But that's wanting to be something beyond what you are.
You're equating ambition with
greed. It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
It
is. It really is.
That's a slippery slope.
One thing I think is important to recognize, too, and I think one of the narratives that I think frames how people think about America is this you know, Horatio Alger story of, you know, if you work hard, you'll get to the top. And one of the things that I think all of us know, if we're honest with ourselves, is we know a lot of people that are in really high corporate positions that aren't there because they were just the most intelligent or they were the smartest people. It has a lot to do with the networks that you're in. It has a lot to do with your access to wealth.
George Bush.
You know what I'm saying? And so it's important for us to not trick ourselves into thinking that the reason why those who are doing well are doing well because they worked hard and we're resourceful, and that those of us that aren't because we're not resourceful enough or don't have the motivation. I think what it has a lot to do, going back to what Dr. Brown was saying, what Lawrence was saying, is that, you know, if we look at income inequality, we look at the way in which wealth and income is distributed, it helps us to understand the terrain is such where it makes it difficult for people of color in particular and poor people in general to be able to access the things that's necessary for us to be successful entrepreneurs. I mean, there are people who can just go to their families and get the loan they need to be able to start a venture, whereas those of us, you know, who don't have that luxury have to do a whole lot more to even get ourselves to a place where we'd be able to have a viable business.
And if you look at the studies, and I'm going to switch gears here and figure out how this fits into one of these city council debates, that if you look at the latest studies, they show that in the so-called, and I mean so-called, socialist countries of Western Europe, things the international balance has changed. In those so-called socialist countries that have all the kind of social underpinnings that keep poverty at bay, that the studies have shown that individual advancement has greater chance in those countries than in this country. The country with the least of the top 50 countries in the world for social advancement people of Baba due to this quote-unquote racial algebra world is the United States of America. Countries that give people a chance because they have equitable school systems, because they have ensure that there's health care for everybody in those systems, those people have a greater chance of rising than we do in this so-called individualistic, you know, get-your-own kind of world. And I think that we lose sight of that. We don't know that. That's why that 60% of people under 30 like the word socialism in America. 60% of people under 30 like the word socialism for the first time. Because I think people are sick and tired of what they're seeing in this country, don't know what to grasp. They're trying to figure out what to grasp. You know, and we were talking during the break about wealth, and it's very real. And how you bring that conversation to the table about wealth and people to understand where wealth really comes from. I was saying that I've been to a lot of events and meet a lot of people and realizing that a lot of the people who are at the top of corporations and doing things, whose families have been here for 200 years, their wealth was built on
slavery,
the backs of the ancestors of the people who are sitting in this room. Yeah. And that's where wealth was built. But we have to kind of figure out how to get that conversation out so the conversation goes beyond just this, you know, like a word's been put out there, reparations, which has been made this kind of bogeyman word nobody wants to address, and how to get that conversation on a larger scale to get people to understand.
And can I say one quick thing?
Go ahead,
I think
David.
Sometimes people don't understand the extent to which there's a disparity in wealth. I'll give you an example.
Right.
In 2011, Walmart made $20 billion in profit. That same year, the top 200 black-owned businesses together made $20 billion. So I don't think people realize the extent to which there's an extreme lack of wealth. And the only way that you get a Walmart, for instance, to get to that level of wealth is through the 246 years of free labor, right? That investment, that economic investment that slavery was in the financial and economic welfare of white folks to be able to be in the driver's seat economically. And I think that is something that is fettered all throughout all the other political issues that we're probably going to talk about.
And it also throws out what happened in D.C. this week when the majority city council said that Walmart has to pay $12 and I think 75 cents an hour was the number they came up with than any comic coming in. And the Mayor Gray vetoed it, and they couldn't override the veto. They had enough votes in the council, even though they had a majority. I mean, that's all part of it, too. I mean, you tell me Walmart can't afford to pay $12 an hour to an employee.
But it's not up to the government to mandate
yes,
for them to do it.
It is
not.
Yes,
that's
it
not
is.
Government's
well, here's,
role.
Well, here's,
yes,
a, here's an
they're
issue.
They're a private been. Entity. It's
well,
not, they're not government has, driven. They're not getting
way,
government subsidies.
There is a
it's,
way, though, that
stay
government
out of our business.
Plays a
no,
role
not
in this.
How, it's never worked that way, man.
But there is a
it's
way that government plays a role in this, and that is when you have these strong mayor systems that give too much power to these mayors. We have one here in Baltimore, strong mayor system. You know, with this Grand Prix issue, there is the issue of Walmart. You know, that's a lot of power to put in the hand of one person. And they're consistently corporate shills. They're engaging in plutocracy, only serving the wealthy and not those at the bottom. And we see this, whether it's the Grand Prix, we see it in the Harbor Point TIFs, we see it in the pilots and other monies that are doled out to corporations here in Baltimore. So this sort of thinking that or this sort of structure that we have in this country where we give mayors an inordinate amount of power and they can overrule, you know, a representative council that represents an entire city. I think something about that really needs to be looked at and changed.
Not to mention the mayor in this city goes in with two appointees having three votes on the board, a very powerful board of estimates. And that's something we've been proposing to change and bring as a charter amendment because it should be left up to the three elected officials that we have citywide to allow for it, or a different model because, as he says, is that she goes right in and she can vote against something. And even if the two other electeds vote against it, she has two appointees who are in their job because of her that essentially are going to vote in favor of anything she says.
Or because of any mayor that might sit there.
Right, and that's the issue.
It doesn't matter what mayor
you have
is,
to look
right.
at the concentration of power. That's really what we're talking about, whether it's the concentration of money, which is wealth, or the concentration of power in these hands of these strong mayors. When you have too much power for folks at the top and not enough at the bottom, you have serious problems.
Chris, I want to jump in before we bring the city council. Let me bring the city council up here, because I think emblematic of that was an interesting vote that in some ways was symbolic, but it was interesting. When the mayor wanted to shift $100,000 out of Parks and Rec to fund two more assistant state's attorneys. And the council actually, en masse, said no. But I think that begs a bigger question that we're not talking about in Baltimore about how you devise a budget, what gets paid for, and where the money should go.
Yeah, I mean, if I can go back, because I agree with elements of what Hassan is saying in terms of the role of government. See, my thing is it's important to have consistency, right? Because in many ways, corporate interests receive subsidies in one way or another from the government, whether it's TIFs, right, whether these are particular tax incentives. And so it's one of those things where it either has to be one way or another. If the government is going to stay out of it, the government should stay out of it and not give incentives to corporations to continue to do the work they're doing. If you're going to give incentives, then you should give incentives in ways to help the largest swath of our population. And I think what you'll find is that the concentration of power in Baltimore is just an example of how that power will always benefit those that have access to that wealth. And therefore, there isn't the parity necessary to have a society where the government can just kind of let things go, because injustice is so entrenched that in order to even make an even playing field, there need to be certain interventions that give the parity if America and you know, cities like Baltimore are interested in calling itself a place where folks can be successful.
Let me open the phones here at 410-309-8888. And see what people are thinking. A lot of people are calling in. And I'll just throw in here that, you know, when you look at the 19th century, the United States of America, let's say, talks about the railroads in this country. We always talked about being entrepreneurial spirit, built the railroads by themselves, went across America, and it made this and made industry. Well, the reality is that every piece of land, almost every piece of land the railroad built on, was given to them by the government. Almost the Carnegie steel mills were on land that was given to them by the government. It wasn't as if I've got the stuff and I'm just going to do it by myself. It never worked that way. It never has, and it never will. I mean, that's part of the mythology of what we have in this country because we don't know our history.
Right, and they gave those things to, you know, those big corporations but didn't give the land to black folks. They were promised after the Civil
War.
And
took the land from somebody else to start with.
Exactly.
410-319-8888. Chris, you're on the air.
Can't see your panel.
Welcome, Chris.
I've recently come up with a proposal. I have a relative who's in the government. And just to put forward some, just in a general conversation, and I know there will be inherently some things that would need to be touched up and so forth and so on. But in fairness, the conversation seems to be that mom and pop can't pay what Walmart can pay. And I understand when they initially instituted a minimum wage back when FDR, whoever it was, under whatever administration, it was there was less competition, there was less industry, etc. So I've been saying, why not base the minimum wage on a company's gross revenue over whatever period of time you want it to be, biannually, annually, whatever. And so then if you, just to throw out an arbitrary number, if you base it on 2% of gross revenue, mom and pop and the big Walmarts are paying the same percentage, but each one would pay an actual different dollar amount based on what they could afford. I don't see why something, in other words, there just needs to be, we can't keep doing things the way we've always done them when we're also about progress. Because as the culture and the society changes, we're going to have to do things a different way. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. Let's get another caller or two in here and get some thoughts. We'll jump right back to the panel. Let you jump right back in, Hassan. I can see you like in the microphone ready to snatch up. Snatch me up anyway. 410-319-8888. Let's go to, oh, we just lost a couple of callers. Well, let's go to, this order. Bruce and Mike. We're going to go to your calls next. Mike, hold on. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I'm listening to this, and it always turns into a black and white issue, a racial issue. So let me straighten you guys out. And I'd appreciate if you at least respect me enough to listen to what I have to say. So obviously, maybe the blacks or more unemployed blacks, and a lot of blacks haven't received a certain amount of financial equality. But you know what? Some of it is nonsense. Let me straighten you out on a generalization. Us white people aren't all privileged. I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood in Dundalk where the majority of people worked at the steel plant at Spires Point at Bethlehem Steel. I don't know any rich people. I don't know any privileged people. I was never given a job because I was a white person. I worked in a steel plant for 29 years. I worked double shifts. I worked my ass off, and I know a lot of other people did too, to get whatever, and a lot of blacks standard to work their asses off too. So whatever they achieve is because they went to work every day and took responsibility for their life. So don't give me this stuff that us white people are privileged. And obviously there are some white people that are privileged, and I don't like these. But don't pull this crap over.
Bruce, just stop saying you're getting a little over the top with your language, but on the air. But I appreciate what you're saying. I think that Bruce has a point.
Well, that's what I said earlier. It's not a black or white thing. I mean, essentially, it comes down to – now, you do have racial disparities. Let's be – so the caller can say what he wants. There is racial disparities in racial history, and especially when it comes to the wealth gap. Let's be honest, historically. But at this point, what we're talking about, minimum wage and things, that has nothing to do with race. That's just Democrats wanting to always intervene and have government in your life. You don't sit there. And I agree with Davon. If you're going to give tips and pilots like the Harbor Point, then you should have mandated agreements, not just what they came up with I hope that you give us jobs. But no, here's the mandated agreement. If we're going to give you this amount of money in tips and agreements, you're going to give us this amount of money back in terms of jobs, employment for this these individuals, because they're pimping the people down there in the projects in order to get these tips. So if you're going to do that, then you need to make sure that these people are taken care of on the backs of the project that you plan to build. But when you talk about what you're talking about, you have $400,000 in Rex and Parks in scholarships that could go to young African Americans or any young kids in this city that has been sitting there for years.
And not used. Right.
Yet you want to transfer the $100,000 over to get prosecutors to lock up these same young people that you don't want to give education responsibilities to. And I'm so glad for the leadership of Councilwoman Helen Holton in the Budget and Appropriations Committee and the council for voting against this measure.
But it begs, and I'll bring up two points really quickly. When the caller mentioned talking about whether or not white people are able to get jobs over black people, there was a study done just earlier this year where a person changed their name on their resume, and it was a young black woman who had been trying to get a job for a long time. She had experience, she had education. She changed her name to a more less ethnically sounding name, to a more predominantly white name, and got callbacks within a day. So that's just not true in that sense. But I will say that every time, it's not always a race issue. Sometimes it's more of a socioeconomic issue, and there's a disparity there, and that's what we're not addressing. But as far as with how the budget is set up and how money is appropriated in Baltimore, I think that maybe there needs to be a look or overhaul of the structure, because if that much money is being is sitting there every year and isn't going towards what it's supposed to go to. And the idea is that, well, you know, we traditionally don't use up that full amount of money, and that is, you know, the common protocol, then clearly there needs to be someone looking at, you know, how this money is being spent and why certain money isn't spent versus others, instead of just reappropriating funds. When the budget was first drawn and created, it should have been appropriated the correct way then.
Which is why we had this, why people wanted audits of all the city agencies. It's not taking place to find out how the money is being spent or not spent.
Yeah, if I can say, I mean, one thing that's really important, I mean, one of the things that I think is a really big issue in this country is, I think it's hard for people to hear conversations about race in rational ways. And this is what I mean, is that if I say that in Baltimore City, the unemployment rate for white folks is 5% and for black people is 15%, that doesn't mean that the 5% doesn't exist. Right. It just means that if we're going to be honest about interrogating issues of poverty, that you have to take in consideration the race, the element that there's, you know, racism and the way that employment and the way the economic development happens. And I think it's important, I think, for black people to be able to talk about our economic situation from the standpoint of our own interests. I mean, other groups organize for the benefit of empowering themselves and their folks. And I think that's a healthy thing. And that black folks shouldn't get bullied into never being able to talk about our particular situation economically, politically, and socially because it makes other people feel uncomfortable or it makes other people feel like they're being excluded. When the history of black folks in the United States is that we're excluded, where the history and contemporaneously, if we look at where we are and the way that policies are being made on our behalf, that typically when you look at black leadership on issues that affect the masses of our people, that oftentimes those voices are oftentimes moderated or mediated by folks' anxieties about talking about race. And I think until we do that, we can't really even – if you don't understand racism and white supremacy, then you can't possibly understand the social economic dynamics that exist in our society.
But I would then throw out as well, and I think that's why these discussions are important to have and maybe have it in a broader arena here on the show with everybody, is that I would posit that most of the progress made in this country has been made when groups – crossed lines and fought for a new America. I mean, he calls a steel worker. That steel workers union he's talked about was a steel workers union made of black and white workers that, like the auto workers and others, that changed the course of those industries because they created a middle class. And they did it with unity. If they didn't have the unity, they wouldn't have been able to do it. It would never have happened. The abolitionist movement was a movement that was a multiracial movement, a minority of people who said we have to change America.
But you know what defeats that move toward unity? Is when you have powerful folks in the media like a Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity that appeal to white xenophobia.
Oh yeah,
and get white folks up in a frenzy, lower class white folks oftentimes, and get them to the point where they end up supporting initiatives that are against their own self interest.
Which is what's happening
and,
all the time.
And again, but that's the seductive power of zero sum thinking.
Right.
When you have power, whether as being an American on a global scale, are being a male in terms of gender relations, or whether you're white in terms of racial relations, when you think that when somebody else is gaining, you're losing, you end up with anxiety and you begin a pushback that ultimately harms and hurts the society.
Let's open the phones here again, 410-319-8888. Good discussion. We were going to come to the city council, but I think it's gone beyond a little bit of that, which is fine. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling. Really, I look at a lot of the issues that we face in America. First of all, I'm an African-American, considered middle class. A lot of my problems, the issues that I face are the tax base that we deal with, where a huge load of what we face in terms of what we pay in taxes is really, I feel like, disproportionate. I feel like, you know, a lot of the institutions that are in place, for instance, like if you look at higher education, exorbitant tuition, this affects not only African Americans, it affects white Americans. And I think one of your panel members stated something very clearly, is that there is a lot of institutional wealth that gives people something to fall back on, and it's not necessarily that African Americans are able to take advantage of it. You know, you look at World War II, for instance. A lot of white veterans who came back. Let's say if you were an airline pilot, not an airline pilot, but a fighter pilot, you could start your own corporation. You know, you may have started American Airlines. But if you're black, you couldn't even fly a plane. So you have a lot of that institutional racism that we are affected by to this day. And I agree that, yes, there is racism that we're still affected by, but I also look at the flip side of the coin. To look at the poverty that we have to deal with, it was like really prophesied in advance by, say, Daniel Patrick Moynihan with the Moynihan Report. And specifically dealing with black single-parent households and the effect that it was going to have on black America. And so that is like really, that's the crux of a lot of what we're dealing with, you know. And so we look at now we turn around, we have a child who's angry with no father who has to now be institutionalized because he is now, quote-unquote, a menace to society. And until we address this problem, we can talk all we want to about wealth distribution. It's just not going to help the great number of masses who are out here just like, I mean, we kind of are.
All right. Mike, I appreciate the call. We have to go to break here in like a minute. Anybody want to have a closing thought before we hit break? We're going to save another 15 minutes. We're going to come back before we meet Mr. Neverdon.
I mean, I don't know if I can give one example of I think a concrete example of institutional racism is that, you know, a few months ago there was, you know, a public hearing in City Hall where they talked about the bond rating for Baltimore City. And a part of how bond ratings are determined are whether financial institutions determine that certain expenditures are good investments. And so, you know, they were talking about all the money they spent to, you know, clean up or to do something about the snow back in 2010. And so one of the things that was disclosed was that, you know, they had to cut the amount of crossing guards, right, in order, and that was seen as an acceptable thing not to invest in, right? That only makes sense to not put money in crossing guards so that kids can get to school. We're talking about in Baltimore City where it's, you know, predominantly black kids that are walking to school and getting to school. It only makes sense that that's an investment that you don't think is a good financial investment if you're not someone who is invested in the livelihood of those folks, and typically we're the ones that bear the brunt of those kind of decisions.
Eliminating the rec centers 2 years ago.
Exactly.
Historically raising
We have to take a break here. We'll be right back with the same guests the next 15 minutes, 410-319-8888. Amanda, you're the next caller up. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our roundtable here with Hassan Giordano, publisher, host of Reporters Roundtable, publisher of DMVDaily.com. Krishana Davis, journalist, writes the Afro-American, at least for a little while longer. And Davon Love, who's director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University. 410-319-8888 is the number. Let's go right to the phone so it's all right with y'all. It's okay. And Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening to the discussion and to the callers coming in, mm-hmm. and the first thing I'd like to say is that a long time ago I had read and also recent commentary on other shows about the minimum wage, talked about Henry Ford when he first started his car company and how he just about doubled the wage of the workers, the new workers that he hired for his company, and other business owners went ballistic and, my God, what are you doing? You're insane. You know, and he said, I want my people to be able to buy my cars. And what people don't understand about a living wage is actually that it benefits everybody. It flows back into the community, the people that work at that company buy more at that company, their friends buy more at that company if they have a living wage. And for people who think, well, it has to be a Walmart business model, they should look. One of the companies that was brought up is Costco.
Right.
I know you talked about the liquor store here,
right.
But Costco pays more than a living wage. And they're doing just fine because their business model has respect for their workers. And the one caller talked about even if you're not Christian, an abundance frame of mind you have to, and not having a zero-sum game mindset, you have to look at it, when one person is uplifted, everyone is uplifted. A rising tide lifts all boats. And for the caller that called in about working at being a blue-collar worker and that sort of thing, I would recommend the book Slavery by Another Name, because there has been consistent, as one of your panelists pointed out, about black pilots not being coming back from the war and not being able to get a job, there's been consistent racism. When the show Who Do You Think You Are, I think that's the name of it, goes into genealogy, there's been time after time where they've gone into black history and someone found an ancestor who was a slave and then was freed and was on, got elected to city council, and then all of a sudden these Jim Crow laws came into place, and not only couldn't they get elected, they couldn't vote. I mean, people need to understand, it needs to be repeated over and over and over again, about this history. And there's a wonderful book called A Different Mirror, about the contributions of all minorities to this country. And it talked about how workers in the sugarcane in Hawaii, had all of them, had gotten together and had gotten benefits for themselves. And also in colonial America...
Amanda, we have to get back to the other callers, but finish this last thought.
Well, that we need to work together, that we have to understand that it is not, as several people have said, it is not a black and white issue, and that we have to help people get from a position of fear that something is going to be taken away from me if somebody else is lifted up.
Okay. Amanda, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it. You laid out a lot there. And I think the company you mentioned, Costco, is an example of a Walmart similarity where people are paid a living wage, where he pays health care, where he takes care of his employees.
But guess what? Henry Ford, Costco, they choose to do that.
No,
they're
actually
not forced by the government to do
you know
that.
What's Hassan?
They choose.
Hassan,
you give a business owner, most nine times out of ten, if you give a business owner the right to choose, they're going to look out for their employees because they don't want them stealing from them first and foremost. They want to pay them a living wage so they can buy their products and do whatever. Most people are good in general, but when you have a government telling them what to do without giving them any tax credits or any corporate tax credits on the back end.
You said earlier
that
greed was good, and now you're saying that people they want to do good for their employees. Which one is it?
No, greed is good. The mentality of greed is good, but that's not being greedy by giving your employees a fair wage.
I would push back saying I think you have a very skewed sense of history. I don't think that's, in terms of what really happened. I think that ultimately – General Motors and all those other companies from Ford in the 30s had to be pushed by workers striking and by the government stepping in to have a wage and health care. They didn't do it on their own. They never do it on their own. When the industries in this country were feeding Americans cheap, dirty meat, and people were dying from the meat they were buying from the slaughterhouses, it took Upton Sinclair and the book that he wrote and a movement starting around that and workers standing up and communities standing up to force the government to make businesses keep the places healthy and safe for people to have. So it never works that way. We have this mythology in America about the great entrepreneur doing things that are wonderful. It never lived like it. That's not reality. That has never been reality. And that in order to make people with wealth move to do things for everyone and for their employees, they have to be pushed.
Do you pay your employees a fair wage?
Look,
you do that because you're a great man, right?
No
government forced you to do
just
that.
Just a second. I'm not going to fall into that trick bag because some people might do that in their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't. And they don't because exploit people to make more money for themselves. And that is just the nature of capitalism. You have to push capitalism back in order for people to be able to live a decent life. That's why it's always worked in this country.
And one quick thing that I think might help inform that part of the conversation, even if you look at corporations that are trying to do well and to be able to employ their employees, you can tell the interests of those corporations based on how they move. A lot of these corporations move their businesses or manufacturing overseas in ways that deny folks in America the kind of wages that was the fulcrum for a middle-class background. So if we look at just what corporations do, we can see that they don't see their interests as tied up, kind of what Lawrence was saying. They don't see their interests as tied up with people. They see it as what can fill their pockets, and not realizing that those jobs being in America could benefit everybody in a way that, you know, we'd have a better society.
Let me go right back to Hassan and everybody else. 410-319-8888. Which caller we go to? Line 2? Benjamin, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
And lady, I apologize. Listen, the New Deal gave us a Bill of Rights to, you're born in America, you got a birth certificate, you got a right to work. Now, we got to have ethics in working. Some jobs are for people, services are for other people. Over there at the harbor, you got services. You got shipment of containers coming in there every day that has to be shipped. That's services. People have to get that merchandise to different locations. If you're working for someone, they're going to put you on that hourly wage, but they want production. If you're not producing, they can't use you. You said Costco. At one time, Costco was hiring contractors to come in at night, which was foreign, to do all of their cleaning their floors and stocking their food. They had to stop that because it was not paying them the way they were supposed to. Some people was doing getting paid, but the foreigners that was doing the work was not. Yeah, I think you might go back and check that because I think it was maybe 7 or 8 years ago that these people that was contracted to do
right,
this with services,
right.
And they had to stop that because they was not giving people work. So when they caught up with them, then they had to start paying people a decent salary to come in there and do a decent job. Walmart say all employees is part of this organization. If you catch someone stealing, then you got to pay for it. So you don't catch nobody stealing. They don't steal. People that steal on jobs, well, their ethics and work ethics is gone. They're shot.
All right. So, Benjamin, we're just about out of time. I appreciate that. Also, just closing thought that we also pay for Walmart. We pay the health care for Walmart. We make sure that the social services are paid for Walmart and food stamps pays for Walmart because they don't pay our employees enough to survive. So we do pay for Walmart out of our own pockets every day as taxpayers. And this has been a really interesting discussion about the city council today. But I will say, Hassan Giordano, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And keep covering the city council for us and bringing those things out that nobody else does and forcing the issue.
We're about to have one tomorrow. It's going, woo, it's a doozy.
We're not on the air. Am I on the air tomorrow? I am. What's today?
DMVDaily.com.
All right, well, maybe have to have you back Monday to talk about the doozy. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, look at that. And Krishana Davis, good luck. What's coming up?
So I will be working at one of the Baltimore Sun's community newspapers in Harford County, the Aegis. I'm really excited. I've had a great time in the city in Baltimore, but on to the next thing.
Person has to make a living wage, right?
Yeah.
Dave, I'm good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I like what and continue to struggle on with young people, and I hope this debate camp you have keeps growing this summer. And
absolutely.
And my commitment is when you do it next summer, we'll know way ahead of time and be able to do it so we can have some young people on here to have some debates on the air and give them some voice out in the community.
Oh, yeah.
Lawrence Brown, you're always good in the studio, man. Always good to have you here.
Always good to be here. Thanks.
Shows the power of Morgan State University faculty and what they bring to the table.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we are going to meet Mr. Russell A. Neverdon Sr., who is put his hat in the ring to run to become the next state's attorney of the city of Baltimore. Looking forward to seeing what he has to say. Stay with us. We'll be right back.